The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is the source of human identity?
I teach literature, so my strong feeling is that human identity is basically a function of the stories we tell, both oral and written. And I think written stories obviously have some advantage in that they're more permanent, but oral histories are a huge part of our identity too. The stories we tell each other, the stories we tell about our families, they really define who we are.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Aaron Parrott about his book titled Montana, Then and Now. As the title of this book suggests, it focuses on the differences, or lack thereof, between the Montana of 1864 and the Montana of today. So what was it like in 1864, which was the year Montana became a territory?
I guess I would qualify my response by pointing out that I wasn't around, so I can't speak with complete authority, but it seems to me that a lot of the feeling you get from reading those accounts around 1864 was that the place was humming with activity, miners, you know, some cattlemen already, lots of commerce and interaction with the Indians. In broad terms, I would say that many of the things about it are similar to the way they are now. There wasn't a lot of people then. There are really relatively not a lot of people now. Big differences, I guess, would be technology. Most of them would have something to do with technology. You know, the fastest you could move around then was a horse. You know, the trains didn't come into Montana until 1880s, so.
But the people who came here were looking for something. They were looking for a new place to start. They were looking for natural resources to take advantage of.
Sure. Right? Keeping in mind that most of the people who lived here in 1864 had been here for a long time, the Indians, of course. But you're right, the mostly European people who came here around that time, many of them were escaping the Civil War or were refugees from the Civil War or in some cases had even been, you know, kicked out by Union commanders who didn't want to take prisoners of war. They just banished them to the territories. But I think that sense of a new place, a new horizon, is a big part of the myth of the West and has been for a long time. And Montana, I think, is one of the last vestiges of that idea that, you know, people come here and start anew.
Yeah, you write about the idea of Montana. What's the definition of that?
You know, that's a tough one, and I struggle with it. I think probably the best piece that I've read on it is still Leslie Fiedler's The Montana Face, which is pretty cynical and somewhat disparaging of the people around 1940 in Montana. But I think there is a big difference between people's idea of Montana as, you know, the last best place, which is sort of a cliche, and what the place really is. It's, you know, a place like any other. And I'm sure people in Idaho are very proud of, you know, their heritage, and people in New England are very proud of their heritage. So I don't think that, you know, Montana is, I mean, it's special to me and people who live here, of course it is, but I don't think there's anything inherently better or final about it than any other place.
So the idea of Montana comes from outside of Montana?
Quite often. I think quite often it does. Yeah. I think people, and I tried to make that clear in the book too, that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I traveled all around the country, and when I would meet people and tell them I was from Montana, some of the things they would ask me just betrays a widespread image of Montana. You know, people would say, do you ride horses everywhere? And things like that.
You suggest that in the 1860s, the West was, quote, a land free from the violence and tensions of the East. How so?
I was speaking mainly in the context of the Civil War. So a lot of these people had come out, especially to Montana, in the midst of the Civil War. the gold rush at Bannock in Virginia City, 1862, 63. You know, those were some of the worst years of the Civil War. So that's mainly what I meant there.
And so people would come here to escape? Soldiers would come here to get away from the war?
I don't know what the actual figures are on the number of soldiers who defected or, you know, were mustered out and ended up out here. I think it's pretty high. And if you look at the histories of a lot of those individual miners, a lot of them were former veterans of the war. The Grand Army of the Republic figures pretty heavily in the early 20th century. You know, and I don't know how anti-war they really were. My guess is that many of them probably just took advantage of the opportunity to escape both the war and try to make a lot of money, as people do when there's a boom.
You also suggest that Montana hasn't changed all that much during the last 50 years as far as the landscape goes and as far as the population goes. Still a fairly low population and still lots of wide open spaces.
Right, and that's probably a controversial point for some. It's relative after all, and one of the things I compare it to is California. In 1864, Montana and California had roughly the same population, at least of immigrants. So, and I pick on Los Angeles specifically. I think in 1864, the population of LA was about 8,000 people. And then 150 years later, the population of Montana has increased 10 times, but the population of California is 40 million compared to maybe 100, 200,000 people in 1864. So that's a dramatic difference. But I would point out that, you know, obviously the landscape looks different with all the highways and infrastructure we've built up, but as a percentage of the actual square footage of the land, I think Montana is still pretty pristine. And we have, you know, thanks in large part to a lot of federal land.
Well, speaking of the feds, well, they sent a delegation to Washington to appeal to Congress for territorial designation. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, they had done this before, but it wasn't until they took back a big bag of gold to show them that Congress decided, well, maybe we should make this a territory. Why were they so anxious to get the federal government involved?
Well, my argument in the book is basically the lack of a rule of law, that the vigilantes were a response to the absolute lawlessness of the territory. The nearest federal post of any kind of jurisdiction, the closest federal judge was in Lewistown, Idaho. You know, that's probably 500 miles from where the stuff was happening in Virginia City. And because there was no real law, you had rampant crime, and all these miners were at a loss as to what to do. So they defended what they did as necessary, and that is vigilantism. But vigilantism is itself illegal and controversial. And so I think, you know, clearer heads prevailed, and they said, let's get, you know, federal recognition so that we can get some real law here. That's my interpretation of.
It seemed like there were so many conflicts at the time. You know, the Native people were trying to hold on to their land and their resources, and the immigrants were coming and trying to get what they could. And everybody got in all these fights, and then they called on the Big Daddy to come and solve it for them.
It is very interesting. And one of the points I make in the book about how things haven't changed that much is that there was great antagonism in 1864 between people who wanted the federal government to have control and people who didn't. After all, you know, we were involved in a civil war over exactly that issue, whether states had control of their destinies or whether the federal government, you know, or whether we were part of a union. And that is still very much in many ways, we're still fighting the Civil War. I mean, many people feel strongly that states should have control. In fact, that's one of the planks in the Republican platform. If you go to their website, it says right in there, we strongly believe in states' rights. So, you know, it's a foundational philosophical difference among Americans. Many of them are divided on that specific issue.
Wasn't that the stance of the Democratic Party back then?
Oddly enough, it's true. You know, you have to remember that the Republican Party originally was very pro-union, anti-slavery, and the Democrats were the ones who were for slavery and opposed to federal control. And those two terms have switched. And I'm not an expert on this at all, but my sense is that it has largely to do with the civil rights movement, and that that division was true up until the mid-60s. And then after the civil rights, all of those Democrats in the Deep South just overnight switched parties to the Republican Party.
Well, the history of women's rights in the state is also quite interesting. Jeanette Rankin, of course, was the first congresswoman, but there were people here in the state who were advocating for giving women the vote long before 1916.
Yeah, that's true. When Montana was drafting its first constitutional convention, drafting its first constitution at that convention in 1889, there was a strong voice for giving women the right to vote then, especially some representatives from Butte. And it's great to go back and read those accounts, because the arguments that they made, you know, for giving women the right to vote were extremely logical, made eminent good sense, and the arguments against were largely knee-jerk and sexist, and the people who were advocating for it, for the life of them, could not understand why they didn't do it. And Wyoming did actually do it, so clearer heads prevailed there. And Jeanette Rankin, since you bring her up, has always been an interesting figure to me, because she's such a huge part of Montana history. And then when I went to graduate school in Georgia, in Athens, Georgia, I was amazed that everybody there knew all about her too. And it was because she retired to Athens, Georgia, and lived the last, I think, 15 or 20 years of her life in a little town right outside of Athens called Bogart, where she continued to protest the Vietnam War. Hmm.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Aaron Parrott about his book, Montana, Then and Now. You can listen to this program again from our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to audio on our Facebook page. Stick around. We'll be right back to talk about the weather. Seriously. And discuss the advantages of tourism. The weather is a constant topic of conversation in Montana, so let's hear a short passage from the book about that.
Here's a weather-related way to win a few dollars taking wagers at your local bar. Ask your companions which city gets more precipitation, Missoula or Great Falls. 9 out of 10 people will assume Missoula gets more. They call it the Garden City, after all. But Great Falls logs, on average, over 15 inches of precipitation a year, compared to Missoula's paltry 13. Helena, by contrast, qualifies as a semi-arid desert. It registers only 11 to 12 inches of precipitation every year. Butte does a little better, but not much. It turns out that Missoula is one of the drier places west of the Divide. Its neighbors to the north get far more precipitation. Kalispell gets 16.5 inches a year, Libby 18.4, and Whitefish a whopping 20.6. By contrast, places in the east get slightly more than Missoula. Billings logs 14 to 15 inches per year, Glendive 13.6. One has to keep in mind that for almost any place in Montana, more than half the precipitation budget comes in the form of snow. In some places, Butte, for example, much more than half of the precipitation comes as snow. Speaking of snow, it may surprise your friends to learn that the greatest snowfall ever recorded in Montana was at Cook City in the winter of 1978-79, when 418 inches were recorded. That's almost 35 feet of snow. Summit, Montana, in Glacier Park, however, is considered the snowiest place in the state, with routine snowfall of 25 to 30 feet per year. Record snowfall at Summit was 369 inches in 1942-43.
The Missouri River, which has a lot of dams on it now, but of course didn't back then, I was surprised to read that Butte actually got their power from the Missouri River, because it's pretty far from the river, and there are a lot of mountains in between. So how did that happen?
That actually was the brainchild of people like Samuel Hauser. And Montana was instrumental in getting that kind of hydroelectric power. The big problem, as you mentioned, was transporting that electricity over huge distances. And it took a lot of different technological developments to make it happen, involving transformers. They had to step the power down at transformer stations every few miles. Took a lot of money invested up front to make that particular piece of the infrastructure work. But once it did, it really changed the face of power in Montana. And I think I am correct in saying this, that transmission line from Canyon Ferry and Hauser Dam, over 60 miles to Butte, was the first long-distance electrical transmission line in the country. It sort of was the litmus test for proving that it could be done.
Wow. Why did you compare the Gilded Age of the 1800s to the present day?
I think I'm not alone in making that comparison. I think a lot of people are recognizing that another really obvious parallel between at least the 1870s and the age that we're living in 150 years later is the extreme concentration of wealth in the hands of very few people and increasing poverty rates and a huge debate about, I guess now we would call it social Darwinism, whether, you know, people are poor because they deserve to be poor and they don't try hard enough, or whether there's other factors that affect them. And you had those same debates in the 1870s. I quote Mark Twain in there. I mean, he was very critical. In fact, he's the one who came up with the term, the Gilded Age. He thought that in spite of the fact that you had really wealthy, opulent features of the American landscape, underneath it was a lot of decay and rust, and it was sort of a sham. And I think that's true in this country too. You know, people think of the U.S. in 2014 as the land of opportunity, but really we have an incredible amount of poor people and very few people at the very top with most of the money. So I think in general terms, those periods are very similar.
I was really delighted to find out that books were very, very important to some of the first immigrants who came, especially to the Virginia City area. They hauled them all the way across the continent, and some of them even parted with a lot of money just to get a few books.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite chapters in the book, and it was largely inspired by an essay, Rick Newby, a poet and I think an alumnus of U of M. He wrote an essay about bookmen on the frontier, and his argument was that many of the early pioneers, you know, we think of them as kind of ragtag or rough and rowdy miners, but a lot of them were really well-educated, came from good families and loved reading and books and literature. And as I went through the historical record, you know, it's obvious that very early on in Virginia City, they had theaters, lending libraries, reading groups, And I start that chapter off with a little vignette from Granville Stewart's diary about how he and his brother rode over 150 miles with winter impending to get five books that they paid $25 for in 1864 dollars. And somebody recently at a reading pointed out that that would be, you know, the equivalent of like $2,500 they spent on books. So I think that's also a huge part of Montana's heritage from 1864. It's always been kind of an intellectual place.
And lots of writers and readers.
Right, yeah.
Then and now.
That's exactly.
Did I understand this bit correctly, that the city of Butte just ignored Prohibition?
I don't think that would be completely inaccurate. I think that's probably putting it pretty accurately that, you know, there were Prohibition agents there, but for all practical purposes, Butte was famous as being a wide open town. In fact, Myron Brinig wrote a great novel called Wide Open Town about Butte, and the feeling was that even though it was illegal, you could get booze, you could get prostitutes, you could gamble, even though all of those things were illegal.
I want to find out a little bit about what it's like to research and write a book like this. Did you spend a lot of time in the Historical Society reading rooms?
I did. I did spend a lot of time, and I hope people don't miss that at the end. I say many thanks to those who were kind enough to consent to interviews for this project and whose names appear within. My deepest gratitude goes also to the staff in the Research Center at the Montana Historical Society. Those people are fantastic, and I do spend a lot of time there. I also have a pretty huge collection of Montana books myself, so a lot of it I could do from home.
How long did it take you to write all this?
I was kind of under time pressure because the publisher said, he pitched the idea to me and said, you realize that you have less than a year because 2014 is the year of the anniversary, so it won't be much good in 2015.
Right.
So I would say 6 months of, you know, pretty intense labor.
And I don't want to give the idea that it's a huge book. It's not. It's 180 pages.
That's true. And it's, you know, I don't also don't want to mislead people into thinking it's a comprehensive history of Montana or, you know, deeply academic or anything like that. It's kind of an informal look at how things were then compared to how things are now, and a lot of incidental history along the way.
There's been the development versus environmental struggle going on throughout the history of immigrants coming into this place, and it's still going on. And at one point you mentioned that there might be some lessons that we could learn from the situations that happened in Butte as far as industry and then Superfund sites and everything, and relate those to what's happening in the Bakken.
I think that's a really excellent point. And one of the greatest parts of writing this book was interviewing Arlene Reichert up in Great Falls. She was a delegate to the 1972 Constitutional Convention when we rewrote our Constitution. And she sort of gave me a play-by-play of that monumental event in Montana's history. And she emphasized the fact that some of the great things that came out of that include an unparalleled commitment to the environment and the natural beauty of this state that no other state constitution has. And maybe a subset of that would be our stream access law, which basically says that everybody in Montana has a right to all of the water in the state, and that you can be on any river up to the natural high water mark anywhere. They can't keep you off of it. So in many ways, it's very progressive, and it was very environmentally minded. And then Tom Tao pointed out that in 1975, other things were passed, the coal severance tax and the Utilities Act, and those are environmental protections that other states don't have. And so really all you need to do is look at what's going on in North Dakota. Their 1972 Constitutional Convention failed, so they didn't get the Constitution protection that we have. Compare that to what's happening in Montana, and it's much slower, much more methodical, a lot more protections involved. And I think that's, just as you say, a result of the lessons of Butte and other places.
So we're not likely to see the creation of another Superfund site because of our Constitution or because of activism, do you think?
That's a really good question. I would say a combination of both. I think it's fortunate that we have the Constitution we do, but I think history has also shown that when people want oil, they will do whatever it takes to get it, and that after all, constitutions and Endangered Species Acts and things like that are just pieces of paper, and they can be adjudicated like anything else. So I think it will take healthy activism, which Montana also has a history of, and that, at least to my mind, has grown in recent years. So I'm hopeful about the, you know, I'm not advocating that you lock up all the coal and oil or whatever, but I think we have to be extremely prudent about any development, especially in light of the fact that the second most important economic driver for Montana right now is tourism, and it's soon to be number one. So
your statistics that you have about what money comes from where were surprising to me.
Those, if we're thinking of the same thing, those all came out of a report that was actually done here at U of M. And there's a, I forget the title of the agency, but they're devoted to tracking all of that stuff just for tourism. I was frankly surprised too at some of it. But that statement about tourism being the number two economic driver, I just heard on NPR the other day. So I'm certain that's accurate. And my feeling about it, this didn't make it into the book, but in an early draft of the book, I compared tourism versus material development, mineral development in Montana. I compared those two to catch and release fishing. Or maybe even a better example would be there's a story about Amarillo Slim, the famous poker player who had an opportunity to completely wipe a guy out at the poker table and take all of his money, but he didn't. He beat the guy and took some of his money. And then later people asked him, why didn't you just wipe the guy out when you had the chance? And his response, he was from Texas, was something like, well, you can shear a sheep many times, but you can skin him only once. And I've always thought of that as a great metaphor for the difference between mineral development and tourism. Tourists come back year after year after year, and there's always more of them, whereas you can cut the coal out of the ground once. You can cut the copper out of the ground once, and you leave that big gaping hole in Butte. So to me, it's a no-brainer.
And the mountain is gone, and the water is ruined. And
right. And it's not just Montana. I mean, go to West Virginia and look what they did to those beautiful mountains.
Aaron Parrott lives in Helena, Montana. There's more about him at our blog. Look for it at mtpr.org/twq. And while you're there, click over to Facebook and like us. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.